Macy's cover band?
Goodwill. Donate stuff, create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Middle East Forum Radio here on WWDB 860 AM Philadelphia Talk. I'm Greg Roman with my co-host Gary Gamble, and we are now joined by Ambassador Robert Pearson, a retired professional foreign service officer who served as U.S. Ambassador to Turkey from 2000 to 2003. He was also Director General of the U.S. Foreign Service from 2003 to 2006, repositioning the American Foreign Service to meet the new challenges of the 21st century and winning two national awards for his efforts. From 2008 to 2014, he was president of IREX, an international development NGO based in Washington, and is currently a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute. He focuses on Turkey with a particular emphasis on U.S.-Turkey relations. Ambassador Pearson, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I hope you had the opportunity to hear a few of the minutes of the last interview, and Professor Aras is still with us, so we're going to maybe have a dialogue in a few minutes. But I got to ask you, just off the top, what was President Trump thinking withdrawing American troops from Syria?
I think he thought that he would expand his support with his base, and I think he thought that he would provide a distracting story about the impeachment process. And he always had said he wanted out of what he calls these endless wars. And he tried this first in December of 2018, as you know, and it never left his mind or his conviction that this is what he wanted to do. And so in another late-night phone call with Erdogan, a replay of the first act, he did the same thing again, and without notifying anyone, he ordered the withdrawal of American troops and began this fiasco.
Right. And this time he didn't have Mattis or Bolton to stop him in his tracks. Both had resigned.
Well, if he asked for advice, everybody would have told him from the military side, from the top to the bottom, not to do it. And so would have been the professional diplomat's advice. But in any case, I seriously doubt if he asked anybody.
That's right. The amazing thing is that this came from Trump's head. This didn't come from the State Department. This didn't come from the military. This didn't come from some faction on the National Security Council. It seems to have been...
I don't know about faction. I think it was really in Mr. Trump's head. I think this is what he always wanted to do.
I have to tell you, though, that just from experience with State Department policy planning, that's the internal think tank of the State Department for our listeners, there are some philo-Turkic individuals. I'm reminded of a former U.S. Army staff officer who was assigned to policy planning about 2 or 3 years ago. There's a position in the U.S. defense establishment that says we must put Turkey before all other Middle Eastern concerns. The same issue was here, Ambassador, and I believe that you may have been involved with this in the American negotiations with Turkey to have the 4th Armored Division invade Iraq in February of 2003. Turkey said no, but we maintain the relationship.
Not entirely the case. I don't know if you want to go in that way, but the truth is that what we did do was maintain a relationship with Turkey in the prospect of continuing to build the relationship. So if you're a diplomat, you don't want to just break all the china. You want to have some way to start again. And we were able to get, for example, humanitarian relief going into northern Iraq almost immediately. But the rocky relationship that resulted when that decision was taken and the 4th Armored Division was denied entry into northern Syria set the stage for a slow but steady deterioration in Turkish-American relations after that.
Right. But I have to commend you, though. You did kind of, you know, fix the issue. And you were put into a uniquely challenging position. I'd like you to take us back almost 20 years now when Recep Tayyip Erdogan is running for office. He is, not he himself, but his party, AKP, is elected in November of 2002. What's happening in Ankara? What's happening in Istanbul? Take us back to his position, and maybe if you can focus just for a second on what he was saying about regional realities, and then how that speech then to now. Is there a constant narrative of the way in which Erdogan has been articulating his foreign policy? Is there some way we can connect his actions in 2019 to his origins in 2002?
Let me start with an answer to that question. The truth is he's evolved the articulation of his position really from the time he came into politics, from a man who was moderate, reached out to all elements of the society, ran on a liberal platform in 2002 to the authoritarian, rather hard line approach that he takes today. So that's the evolution. The situation at the time, in 2002 and 2003, was that this party had never been in national power. They had gained support because they actually did things for people at the common level, and reached out to communities in a way that these established parties didn't do. The established parties faced a number of charges of corruption, and they had frankly run out of energy. And for a year at least before the election in 2002, we in the embassy knew that the support for this party, Erdogan's party, was running at about 30%, which is a high number for Turkey. But none of the people in the establishment, when we talked to them, would accept this as credible. They thought that these were manufactured numbers, and then when the result occurred and Erdogan's party was elected, they were quite shocked, but we were not.
I mean, if you look at what Erdogan's first foreign policy moves were back in 2003, his first visit was to Greece, trying to put to bed historical animosity between the Turks and the Greeks. And then you see him having this tour of the Middle East. I mean, he really was on the way to trying to moderate, or some semblance of moderation, for what an Islamist and a Democrat could do together. But now we see the result of what's happened some 17 years later. What is next for U.S.-Turkish relations? We have a very hostile Congress, almost using the same kind of rhetoric that they used against Saudi Arabia after the Khashoggi incident. We have sort of a mollified Lindsey Graham and Senator Chris Van Hollen maybe pushing a little bit back on the sanctions bill in the Senate. But where do we go from here?
Listen, if this relationship were on a heart monitor today, it would be flatlined. And so we have to start all over with this relationship, and it's going to be extremely difficult. Mr. Trump thought he was doing Turkey a favor on October 6th, and 2 days later, he made Turkey an enemy by assessing sanctions. So nothing that has been done since then has had any positive effect for U.S.-Turkey relationships. And so we don't have anything to play with now. There was a proposed deal for a trade agreement between Turkey and the United States. That was withdrawn. And so the consequence is that we are going to have to start from zero with the Turks. And we're starting from zero at a bad point.
Now, you wrote an article in January of this year that to Ankara, controlling the political future of the Kurds is an absolute priority. Do you think that the U.S. should recognize Turkey's, call it Monroe Doctrine or the Erdogan Doctrine, that the way in which the Kurds' political future in the region is inherently tied to the Turkish political evolution or security of their being able to govern well in their country? Or should there be some sort of Kurdish self-determination and America should recognize that?
Well, if there is Kurdish self-determination or some level of autonomy, it's going to be because the countries themselves either agree to it or accept it. And as you already know, the Kurds are scattered in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. So that's a steep mountain to climb. The U.S. Was right in asserting that the Kurds had a right of self-defense. It was the Kurds who were attacked by ISIS in 2013 and 2014. The Yazidis, we all remember that tribe. The Yazidis were slaughtered by the ISIS fighters. Their women were made sex slaves. Their men were killed. Their children were recruited into the ISIS armies. And no one else stepped forward to protect them or help them. So we did. And they were marvelous in helping us with bringing ISIS to the point of near collapse, not total collapse. And our function there should have been to keep a presence in order to ensure that the Kurds made the best deal possible with Damascus and with Turkey regarding their future in Syria. And by fleeing, as we did, we made it impossible for them to do that, and they had to jump into the arms of the Russians and the Syrians just for survival purposes. That's where we are today.
If I'm going to shift really quickly to Professor Aras, Do you believe that it is in Turkey's interest as a NATO member to have Russia on its southern flank now in place of the United States, who is ostensibly an ally? I mean, as much as it was irresponsible for President Trump, in my opinion, to suddenly withdraw American forces from Syria, leaving the Kurds to the whims of the Syrians and the Russians, is it in Turkey's long-term interest to have itself viced between Russia in the north and now Russia in the south?
Well, actually, it is not. But however, when you look at the, how the geopolitical game played out, this is the point where we came at the moment. So the Mr. Trump thinks he can control Mr. Erdogan. And on the other hand, Mr. Erdogan thinks he found a person in Washington, and he is the president of the United States, that understands Turkey's legitimate security concerns. So I think, you know, there were two problems which brought us to this point. The one is, you know, not thinking much about, you know, the future PYD or YPG's relations with the rest of Syria, and in particular with Assad, when providing, you know, international recognition and protection to YPG. And the second is the Turkey's, you know, security concerns, and how this Kurdish entity, you know, the possible Kurdish entity, is a, you know, serious issue in Ankara. So this, you know, lack of attention to these two issues while, you know, dealing with another major issue, you know, defeating ISIS, which is, you know, actually that was a must, and the Kurds real, you know, helped in that cause. But however, at the end, you know, the ISIS has been defeated, but these two issues now brought us to this point, and the, you know, this overall Russian dominance in Syria. You're looking at the realities on the ground. Russia is the only, you know, Russia is the only capable actor who can, you know, dictate YPG to do something, dictate Assad to something, talk to Iran. This is actually, you know, a point no one expected to see in this time.
Professor Iris, I have to push back on that point of us thinking that the Russians would not fill a power vacuum that would have been created by an American withdrawal. I think everyone saw that happen. I mean, if you look at the statements that were just being made in the U.S. Senate, and if Senator John McCain of blessed memory were here with us today, he warned us about Russian intentions in Syria going all the way back to 2012, 2013 with his visits on the Turkish-Syrian border, about if the U.S. was not there, another force would have come to fill the vacuum, one which may be anathematic to American interests. Ambassador Pearson, what do you think of Professor Iris's point of view, where the YPG was, the PYD, in some way or another, cousins of the PKK, brothers in arms, whatever you want to call it. I don't know how I feel about that characterization. Are a existential threat to Turkey, demanding the Turkish invasion of northeast Syria. Do you think that this is something that is a correct assessment that justified the invasion, or do you think it's politicking for Erdogan to try to achieve something else?
Well, they are kissing cousins. There's no doubt about that, and they sympathize with each other. But there is no evidence whatsoever that the YPG was supplying arms, especially American-manufactured arms, to the PKK, which we all recognize as a terrorist organization which wants to carve out separate territory in Turkey. So if there had been, to be honest with you, the Turks would have known about it, and they would have made a huge play of it. And so it didn't happen. The YPG was not doing that. And they were more interested in the protection of their own people and their own territory in northeastern Syria. And they actually had some small units of Syrian government forces here and there in the territory they controlled, just to be sure they had a few cards on the table to play if they needed to. So I don't think they were an existential threat to Turkey. I think that Mr. Erdogan wants to have a kind of hegemonic control over the geography of Syria, south of the Turkish border, and he has tried for years now in Afrin and Idlib and Aleppo and along the northeastern border with Syria to establish that kind of hegemony and get the Russians to agree to it. But the Russians have never agreed to it, and they push the Turks out of every bit of that geography they can, and they will complete that job. And they will, now with their joint patrols on the border with Turkish forces, something Erdogan really did not prefer to have happen, but is happening, backed by Syrian government, state armed forces, sooner or later the Russians are going to say to the Turks, please leave Syria, and it will happen. So I think that Mr. Erdogan's done this for purely political reasons at home, unfortunately. He needs to shore up a base that is weakening, and he had disappointing results in a Istanbul election in June, very disappointing results. And this is his way of trying to rally his supporters to back him in his other domestic actions. And a lot of people have suffered as a result of it.
A quick follow-up question. Everybody who justifies the Turkish invasion or disputes the credibility or intentions of Kurdish forces in northeastern Syria, they always bring up the guilt by association linked to the PKK. And I think Kissing Cousins is an accurate representation. Obviously, there are ideological, tribal, all sorts of links between the two groups. It's all based upon the designation of the PKK as a terrorist organization, which was done many years ago. Briefly, do you think that terrorist designations should stand? I mean, it always struck me as being in part a political and strategic concession to an American allied Turkey. Is it time to reconsider it?
Well, let's look at it from, say, the other end of the telescope. When we were trying, the UK and US and others were trying to bring peace to Northern Ireland, we didn't start by deciding the IRA was not a terrorist organization. We started with a dialogue process that led to a peace agreement, which led to the promise of the political involvement by the IRA and its colleagues in the politics of Ireland rather than terrorist acts. So if you wanted to do this right, you'd start a dialogue with the Kurds, which would be a very good idea, and eventually you would reach an accommodation.
Right.
So, Professor Aras, I want to kind of move away. There's been an elephant in the room that we have not talked about yet in this discussion. We've talked about American-Turkish policy, America's relations with the Kurds, Turkey's, I think, you know, legitimate views of Kurdish terrorism. And also those who are not necessarily being so violent towards the Turks, at least not until Turkey invaded northeast Syria. What is the reaction to this military action by Turkey within Turkey, especially amongst its Kurdish minority group? We have Saladin Demirtas, the head of the HDP, the Kurdish Nationalist Party, that is currently in a Turkish jail. 23 Kurdish mayors of Kurdish-majority towns in southeast Turkey are also in jail. What's the take domestically for or against Erdogan's actions?
Well, to address the question of, you know, whether PKK is a terrorist organization or not, I think there is a confusion about, you know, on the one hand, there is, of course, a mismanagement of the Kurdish problem in Turkey and mistakes of Erdogan government. But on the other hand, you know, the PKK is an armed organization, pursuing terrorist organization, almost, you know, very weakly. So we need to make this, you know, this differentiation. And in order to come to the point of IRA and other examples, the PKK should at least, you know, declared an intention to withdraw from this armed attacks to Turkish civilians and military targets. When it comes to, you know, what's happening in Turkey, the current, you know, this nationalist coalition in Turkey, nationalist conservative in Turkey, is a kind of, you know, worst formation to deal with the Kurdish problem. So So they consolidate, they support base, you know, throughout those national sentiments and kind of victories that can present to their support base. And that's why, you know, there's the encouragement and, you know, this tougher attitude towards the Kurds has been an issue in lately. And so there are segments of society who oppose this incursion, and they say, you know, there should be other ways, like, you know, going back to the dissolution process. But however, you know, considering the post-2016, you know, the coup environment in Turkey, there is a very strong nationalist coalition with almost, you know, 50% support of Turkish electoral base. They support this move. But however, this is a process, you know, and now they think something necessary has been made. But however, they will judge it according to what it is going to produce. Will it going to help the solution of Kurdish problem? Well, to my understanding, it will not. So when it comes to see what it's going to produce, then they will, you know, have a better judgment of it. Now, there is a psychology that, you know, this, our army is in a war with our arch enemy, so the whole world is united against us. So at this point, there is, you know, a considerable support to Erdogan government and military incursion to northern Syria. But as I said, they will have a better judgment after seeing, you know, what it's going to produce.
Right, but the likelihood that if you criticize Erdogan, his government, or his political party, especially after 2016, that you'll end up in jail is a lot higher than that of, you know, prior to the alleged events of July 2016.
Depending on security support and its own base, Erdogan is going to be harsher or milder inside Turkey. And he will also like to see what kind of results it's going to produce in domestic politics.
Understood. Ambassador Pearson, so we have this U.S. president, we have this Turkish president. They seem to be like they're in lockstep now, at least in the way in which they're approaching the issue. Turkey wants to be able to control the Kurds outside of its territory, extraterritorial control. It's now the Americans have abdicated the responsibility for Syria to the Russians and the Syrian government and to the Turks themselves. Let's look at the Turkish opposition in the United States and the ways that public figures in the Democrat and Republican Party in Congress, at least those who disagree with the president, should behave towards this situation. Do you think it's time, for instance, that maybe the Kurdish National Congress should be invited to testify before the Senate or the House, or maybe even go so far as to inviting Fethullah Gulen to the Senate to speak with senators? I mean, should Erdogan realize that there is not unanimity in support for his actions in this country?
To be honest with you, Erdogan doesn't care what the U.S. does, because they have now completely abdicated any influence or control in Syria. They have nothing on the table with Turkey that Turkey would find appealing to bargain about. So the real question is whether the Senate will pass a veto-proof, heavy sanctions bill that would punish Turkey economically as a result of the incursion. I think that President Trump and his allies are working strenuously to let the heat about this issue out without allowing any of the substantive reaction that the Senate's been talking about. So there was a House resolution condemning the Turkish incursion. It had no sanctions in it, passed by a huge majority. Now they're working on a Senate version of the same sort of thing. Lots of condemnation, no sanctions. It will probably pass the Senate, but any attempt to pass a veto-proof bill in the Senate would be met by strong opposition from Mitch McConnell, and will have a very difficult time passing. So if it doesn't pass, then there's nothing that will be done against Turkey that is more than window dressing, and the U.S. will eventually be regarded as a non-player. I would like to say one additional thing, and that is that one of the parties not notified about this decision was Israel. So the Israelis have been very quiet the last 3 weeks. They were unhappy when Pompeo showed up to explain the deal, and understandably so. But they were before, and the U.S. did this without any kind of consultation with the Israelis and put them really in a very difficult position.
Ambassador Pearson, as a former political appointee in the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, I share your concern with what happened on this, but was trying to keep this of the binational conversation. We'll do more of a regional perspective next week, but thank you for that important contribution.
It's a very important point because no surprises is one of the big pillars of the relationship.
Professor Bulent Aras of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, a visiting scholar there, and Ambassador Robert Pearson of the Middle East Institute. Thanks for joining us. This is Greg Roman and Gary Gamble with the Middle East Forum Radio Hour signing off. We'll see you next week.